Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch, grass-fed beef raised on California's Central Coast. Now available online through Larder Meat Company. Learn more at HearstRanch.com.
Hello, welcome to Cooking in Mexican A to Z. I'm Aaron Sanchez, your host, along with my mother, Salem Martinez. And today we're joined by very talented Donna Abramson, who is the Calustian Manager of Operations, a fantastic 76-year-old international spice and specialty food shop in Murray Hill in Manhattan. It is an unbelievable place for those who do not know. It literally boasts a collection of more than 10,000 food products from over 80 countries. And Donna, we've known each other for many years. My mom and I have known Donna. She was owner of a great place, restaurant and store called Kitchen Market, where she focused on Mexican ingredients and delicious food. And we're here talking about chipotles, right? And chipotles and their all their luster and beauty and different ways that we can sort of explore this ingredient, talk about its flavor profiles, how it's used. I think we're going to also talk about a quick recipe, and then my mom is going to go into some wonderful stories, and we want Donna to sort of break down the finer points of the chipotle.
Well, okay, let me make a little correction here. Yeah. We are covering all sorts of smoked chilies.
Okay, we are.
Not just chipotles.
Yep, you're absolutely right. I stand corrected. We are doing a smoked chili tutorial.
Exactly.
Yes.
I like that.
Okay, so let's kind of start with Donna. If you don't mind kind of talking about the smoked chiles and sort of their variations and different ways that you can sort of find them, how to use them, how to store them. What are your thoughts about smoked chiles, Donna?
Well, my background before being the manager at Calustians was the co-owner of Kitchen Market, which is a Mexican grocery. And that opened in 1985 until 2007. There were very few places to buy chilies in New York. There was a place, Casa Maneo, that had closed just as we were opening. Very good for us. And most of the chilies that we sourced came from Mexico, some from California, often through New Mexico. Chipotles were probably the most common smoked chilies at that time. Most the people that did know about them mostly were familiar with the canned chipotle and adobo, which are chipotles in a sort of barbecue sauce that you could use separately or puree them together. They spawned the ubiquitous chipotle mayo that's still being served and used many 20-odd years later. Chipotle moritas are another variety. There's different types of jalapenos that are smoked and dry. They have a fantastic heat to them and smokiness. A number of years later, I'll say in the mid-90s, we heard about a smoked chili from Oaxaca called Pasilla de Oaxaca.
My entry there.
There was only one place to get them, the chili guy out in Bernalillo, New Mexico, and we were very excited to bring them in. Pasilla negros are more common as a sweet, earthy pasilla, but these are smoked in a very particular way in a particular village in Oaxaca. And Zarela, do you want to talk
because
about that?
That village gave me my tagline. You know, when I was doing my research for the Oaxaca book, we came upon this graduation ceremony in this little village high up in Mount Sempatepetl, which is very hard to get to. There was a graduation going on, and they invited us to the celebration that followed. And we came into this little room, and the Continental was playing on the radio, and there were faded roses on the little oil cloth. And they sat us next to this teachers. And then one of the parents stood up and said, Hago este ofrecimiento. I make this offering. Porque solo no se puede compartir la vida. Because alone one cannot share life. Others must be there. And I think that that is one of the most beautiful sayings. And I mean, I adopted it as my tagline. Alone one cannot share life. Mm-hmm. But just to put this village in context, for I don't know if you all remember about this French designer who was sued by a tribe of indigenous people from Oaxaca because they appropriated their embroidery and won. So this is this little town.
Oh, wow. That's awesome.
And they make the chiles de pasilla de Oaxaca.
Oh, I love it. Yeah, I mean, for those who have not been to Oaxaca, it is probably one of the most magical places in Mexico to really understand the culture. I think now it's become very popular. A lot of people make culinary pilgrimages to Oaxaca to seek out the wonderful moles. They call it the land of the seven moles. The indigenous people, the Zapotecs, are a fantastic group of people. It's a matriarchal society, so it's no wonder that I'm here with two powerful, strong women. So it's apropos that we're talking about Oaxaca. So Donna, I think it's important that maybe you can touch upon the different kinds of chilies. They're not always dried and smoked, and there's a huge gamut of fresh chilies as well.
One thing that most people don't realize is that green chilies are immature chilies, and all chilies, like all peppers, bell peppers, whatever, when they're left on the vine, on the plant, will turn red. So most, I'll say probably 99% of the dried chilies we see are chilies that were grown green. There are different names for chilies. An ancho is a poblano, a pasillo is a chilaca. Mm-hmm. Most of them have different names in their green fresh form and then in their dried red form. They're kept on the vine till they're red, and then they are dried. A beautiful trip is to go out to New Mexico in the fall, and you'll see red chilies hanging off of every rooftop drying as ristras as a way to preserve them for the winter. Mm. Now, they're also in New Mexico, they dehydrate green chilies, which is a very different process because they're not drying on the plant. They're picked when they're fresh, but they dehydrate them. They're called pasados, and they look like a piece of leather. They don't even look like a chili anymore, but when you rehydrate them, you get this amazing, meaty chili. Well, so the drying of chilies is a way to preserve them for the future. Some chilies, because of the tradition in the region they're grown, are smoked. Mm-hmm. But most chilies are just dried, and then there's the handfuls of chilies that are smoked, and that's their application.
So a little note. At the ranch, we used to do chile pasado, but what we did was that we roasted the chili first, so it had that flavor, and then hung it out to dry
roasted first.
Yeah,
oh,
so
nice.
It did not stay in the plant. So you know, you roasted it first and then hung it up. And I have some at home, and it's like this seductive, wonderful flavor. And I remember my comadre Lupa used to make the stew with those chilies and potatoes. Mm. It was so cool.
So I think, Donna, you kind of talked a little bit about the chipotle, its different iterations and you know, how it could be differentiated between the kind of jalapeno, how it's treated. In your opinion, how has the popularity of smoked chilies in general exploded over the last 10 years? And are people being a little bit more adventurous with heat in general, with flavor of chiles?
Oh, definitely. I have to say, at Calustians, where I've been a manager for the last 6 years, we have a wall of chilies, so
Didn't you bring some along?
And I did bring some chilies. I was going to say we have at least, I think, about 8 or 10 different varieties of smoked chilies. Mm. I didn't bring any chipotles, but let's see what I have. I have a smoked ghost pepper, the buchiloquia, which is a delicious, very, very hot, about 1 million Scoville units, very hot, but a delicious smokiness. We also have a Burmese smoked chili flakes from IMR that they roast and smoke, and it's very delicious and used a lot in the Burmese cooking, both in their salads and noodles.
Mm-hmm.
This is slightly off, but the Urfa Biber from Turkey has very delicious smoky flavor. It's actually fermented after they sun-dry them. They wrap them and ferment them, and somehow it gives it a delicious smoky roasted flavor, and that's very popular. Middle Eastern Turkish foods are really trending right now, so that's been an incredibly popular one. We also, a little possibly off, have smoked black peppercorns, so I think, and we probably have about 10 to 15 varieties of smoked salts.
Wow.
So the smoking process, whether it stems from people liking barbecuing or grilling, has just really exploded smoked products. Another new, relatively new thing for us is a smoked basmati rice that's used in the north of Iran. And I've read how they put the rice in big cloth sacks and they hang it over wood fires and keep spinning it and circulating it so the smoke penetrates the basmati rice that's grown in India, but then it's smoked and it's used in traditional northern Iranian products. And I've actually brought a bag and I actually cooked some for Zarella and Aron to try. That's really delicious. So people are in general becoming more adventurous in cooking. We have customers from all over the world, but as tourists as well as people living in New York. Many of them are now saying, oh, yeah, I remember my grandmother used to make that. I want to make it. When it used to be people ran away from the traditional old cooking, that's coming back. And very cross-cultural.
Yeah.
People from all over, you'd see people from India that want to cook Mexican food. And
I love it.
You know, really, it's a big mashup there, and that's so exciting and so fantastic.
Well, let's talk a little bit about Chipotle, how we use it.
Yeah.
You know, because I mean, I remember distinctly the first time I had Chipotle. You know, it was in the university, and they used to make this tortas ahogadas. You know, from Veracruz, it was like this roast pork sandwiches, like a French dip, except you'd soak it in this chipotle tomato sauce. And I didn't make it for years and years, but 20 years later, I could make it just from memory because the flavor was fantastic.
In Guadalajara, no?
In Guadalajara.
Yeah.
And that's the one place, that one of the dishes that I just long for all the time.
Yeah.
But normally what I do is that I make this chipotle paste. You know, because it's just very simple recipe. It's you get 2 garlic cloves in the food processor with about a teaspoon of salt. You puree that. You add like 1 or 2 teaspoons of Mexican oregano that you're going to crush between your hands to release the aroma, like my mom used to say. And then 1 can of chipotle, so you're going to whirl all of that in and then whirl in some olive oil. And then you can put this on so many things. Mayonnaise to make the chipotle mayonnaise. Vinaigrette to make a chipotle vinaigrette. And, you know, slather it on salmon and cook a grilled smoked salmon on top of the stove. So anyway, so it's boundlessly useful. And I use it, I mean, all the time because I have this theory that bacon and chipotle are good even with shit.
Yeah, exactly.
They say that chipotle is the vegetarian's bacon. And I second that idea.
I do.
Being a vegetarian.
I mean, the popularity, we were talking earlier about that the huge Mexican chain that's everywhere in America, they could have chose any dry chili to name themselves after, but they chose chipotle, right? So there's something to it. It's wide appeal, I think, really speaks to a lot of different audiences, and I think that's why it has a perfect amount of heat, and the smokiness, I think, reminds people of cooking outdoors and communing. There's something that's very ephemeral that happens when you eat smoked dry chilies. You know, Mom, you're talking about how you use the chipotle. You know, in my second book, I have a recipe called Chipotle Love, which is sort of a variation of your paste. I actually roast or confit the garlic. Cloves, and then I take that residual oil and I puree that with a can of chipotles, cilantro, and lime zest. I actually love that
that
combination, and I use that as a marinade for chicken.
That sounds good too.
Yeah, so
but doesn't the lime zest get bitter, and then you have to use the sauce that same day?
Yeah, well, that's the one thing about it. You're absolutely right. That zest, it's not just get bitter; it just perfumes it. But with the oil, it adds a sort of like a preservative almost. It kind of it stunts that from happening.
And how do you use it?
I use it in marinades mostly. I'll take chicken We'll rub that, let it sit overnight, grill it, and I just think it's wonderful. The same thing, we use vinaigrettes with it very commonly. We'll mix it in mayonnaise or now, you know, people call it an aioli and they charge you $5 more, but it's mayonnaise at the end of the day, right?
With crema or something.
Yeah, or crema as well. Yeah. So I think it's wonderful, you know, and I think for you, Donna, you know, you're talking about the different variations. There's the morita, there's the chipotle meco, and then, of course, the chile pasilla de Oaxaca. And, you know, the pasilla, I would like to talk a little bit more about that particular chile, because I think for a lot of people, the pasilla is starting to get a lot more popular. Pasilla means, you know, small raisins or little raisins. And I think that it's called that because not only the color, but I think it also has a little some sweetness to it, no?
Yeah, a nice earthy sweetness.
Once you get past the spiciness.
Well, even with the pasilla negro, which is, I guess, where it starts from. No, when people come to me.
Excuse me, but no.
Oh, it's a different type of pasilla?
Yeah, no, pasilla negro is more related to the ancho. Mm. And it's actually, not to the chilaca. It's not related at all to this. Mm-hmm. The pasilla is like the chilaca.
Is a chilaca. Right, chilaca. So when people come asking me, oh, I want to make chili, what should I use? You know, they want to buy the American chili powder, which has all the stuff blended in. And I said, no, you have to put at least two or three chilies. And I always suggest using pasilla or ancho as a base because of that earthy sweetness that I think pasillas give. And that combined with the smokiness and the pasilla de Oaxaca is just a delicious aroma.
Well, you know what we do?
You get the sweet, earthy, and then the heat, and it's fantastic.
What we do is that we stuff it with a picadillo, with plantains and apricots and onion and garlic, and then we used to serve it in a bowl of almond soup. Because, you know, when you think about it, when the Spanish conquered Mexico, it had only been 100 years since the Muslims were expelled. So a lot of the food of Spain at that time was Moorish. So this almond soup with this wonderful chili in the middle is fantastic.
Yeah, Mom, and you were, you know, your restaurant, Sarela's, your namesake restaurant, which opened in 87, really was, you were the pioneer of Mexican cuisine, not only in New York City, but you can argue in the country. You brought flavors and techniques to the biggest food city in the world, which is New York, and you did it with unbelievable innovation, talent, technique, and deliciousness.
Thank you, baby.
And it was, I mean, I can't tell you how many times I get stopped when people say, oh, your mom, Sarela, right? I miss this and this dishes. Yeah. You know, some restaurants are lucky to have one dish that people remember. You had an arsenal of dishes that people longed for, whether it was your creamy rice, whether it was your – that's probably the one that people ask for the most, though, is the creamy rice. But your enchiladas, I mean, you were doing things like
– I smell a business there, honey.
Yeah.
The Sarela classic dishes.
Yeah, and it really influenced so many people, and I think – you know, when Donna opened her store, I know that you guys were kind of in that same time frame. And I remember you said, you have that great line that says, the Folders Guide at the time said that Mexican food in New York City has a striking resemblance what a howling monkey has to man, right?
The uncomfortable resemblance that a howling monkey has to man.
And how much has changed, right?
Yeah.
And you both of you ladies have opened the door for so many chefs. I recall going to Kitchen Market, Donna, and buying ingredients all the time from you.
Right, and I was saying that when Aaron's early days as a chef in New York at Centrico and Paladar, we were selling him chilies and cheeses and tortillas, and look how far
sorry,
he's come. We're
missed,
so proud of him.
You missed El Rey.
Oh, I
and
know
you
Ray.
Missed Isla.
Yeah. Yes.
All so my other ones, yeah. But
I've been competing with this guy for 25 years, 30 years now.
Yeah. And you know what? I think now we're all comfortable in our skin and where we are in life.
Exactly.
And at the end of the day, I'm carrying your legacy on, Mom. And we're very blessed, you know, I think to have had a perspective of when really American regional cuisine was born. And you guys were very much part of that scene. People don't realize people like Paul Prudhomme and Larry Forgione and yourself, Donna, all these people really forged the identity of what American regional cuisine is. And you guys were part of that movement, which is so amazing. And I really hope that the new culinary generation does not forget that.
I know.
And I really believe that culinary schools You know, I have my scholarship, the Aaron Sanchez Scholarship Fund, where I send young Latino kids to culinary school here in New York City. And one of the things I think the school should teach is like sort of the birthplace of all of these culinary masters. So it's not forgotten, all the contributions.
Yeah.
And how you guys have really formed opinion in the early days of this food revolution.
Well, you know, I mean, not to brag too much, but but in 2004, the Department of State did a study of food trends in America, and they named seven people who had changed the way Americans eat, and I was one of them.
That's awesome.
Fantastic.
Yeah, that's huge.
As you should be.
That's huge.
Well, it's just, it's for me, it's so exciting to see people trying more and more Mexican things. And I think that's one of the great things about chipotles is that people can have it in the refrigerator, slather it on a piece of salmon, grill it on chicken, you know, chicken breast. Yesterday, I've developed this technique. It's where I get the whole chicken breast and slice it, you know.
Butterfly it.
But not, but to the bone. It's on the bone.
Yeah.
And slather the chipotle paste and then cook it for 45 minutes at 350 or 375. And then I just slice it and I make my mango salad.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Which is, you know, I make this, I slice mangoes and I put some chipotle vinaigrette, cut the chicken in slivers, dust it in chipotle vinaigrette as well, and serve my girasol, my sunflower salad.
Yeah, I remember that. That was another one of your classic dishes that you had at your restaurant.
Yeah.
And, you know, talking about the chipotle just briefly, I think it's such an important ingredient because it's canned.
Yeah.
So think about someone that lives in Sioux Falls, Iowa, that doesn't have a Latin neighborhood in their city and can't have access to these wonderful smoked chilies that Donna so beautifully curates at Calustians. The canned chipotle is probably your only option, you know, be able to have these Mexican flavors introduced into your kitchen. So I think it's very significant, the canned chipotle, because it travels.
Exactly.
You know, and I think that's really something to be said.
And I think it really has been a bridge for the average American who, either by hearing the name chipotle, by having chipotle mayo on a burger or a sandwich somewhere, thinking like, oh, chipotle, yeah, when they stop and think about it, that's Mexican. Oh, now I know how to do something, and how can I use that and carry that over? Wait, maybe they won't mix it with mayo. Maybe they'll make a marinade or a rub. It's bringing them an introduction into the world of Mexican cooking.
Well,
and
even Queen Elizabeth has had chipotle chilies.
Of course.
Because Craig Claiborne said that Mike Dieber needed a soup to serve the queen when she went to the Reagan Ranch.
Wow.
And I sent him my Carlos Trelpeño and cans of chipotle, and they served for this particular soup, which was incorporated into the White House menus. So it's caldo trapeño. And you know what? You can find this recipe on my website, www.zarela.com, Z-A-R-E-L-A.com, for those who don't know me. And anyway, you have myriad recipes and techniques and everything else there.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I work with Gordon Ramsay, and he brags that the Queen of England has his fish and chips every Friday. So you brought it up. I thought I'd give a little shout-out to my compadre, my colleague, Gordon Ramsay.
He's so adorable.
Oh, he's great. I think one thing that we kind of overlooked, guys, is how do you store the chilies once you get them from Calustians, which I'm sure all of you guys will go and patronize. It's on 33rd Street, correct?
Lexington and 28th.
So let's say when you buy the chilies and you remove them from the bag, I think some people assume because they're dry that they won't go bad on you. But actually, dry chilies can get brittle, and they can actually kind of lose their intensity. So, Donna, what are your thoughts of storing dry chilies once you buy them?
Well, we recommend actually with chilies and all spices to keep them away from heat and light and moisture. So they can go into a Ziploc bag, into a storage container, a glass jar. You want to keep them in a cooler cupboard. It's ironic that for so many years they put spice racks above the stove, which is the worst place for them. They get the condensation, the moisture, and the heat, which they don't need. A bright light also will fade the chilies, both in color, and it does detract from the flavor as well. So you want to keep them securely dry and in a cool place, not in the fridge, not in the freezer. Because they are an agricultural product, there is the occasion where you might find moths growing in them. you can throw them in the freezer for a couple days, then sift out any moths
and
you see
can,
on the
you
bottom.
You can eat the moths.
And yes, one could eat them too.
Yeah.
But you don't have to be afraid of them. The freezer will kill them, and then you can just
And then you will eat killed.
And I think there's nothing wrong also with dating. If you put them in a bag, date them.
Sure.
So you have some an idea of when you purchase them. I think that it's very helpful.
Although
you
know, I have to say something, we closed the Kitchen Market 12 years ago. I have two things in the back of my cupboard from them. I have a bag of canela, Ceylon cinnamon in sticks, which I ground recently and was incredibly fragrant.
Beautiful.
And some chili pasada, which are green chilies
that
have been dehydrated from New Mexico. They look like a piece of leather. But I pulled them out of the bag, still with their Kitchen Market label, and rehydrated them, and they were fantastic.
But let me ask you something. Don't you think that the smoking itself acts as a preservative, you know, for smoked chilies? You know, because I think, I mean, I just put pulled out all the smoked chilies I have at the home and then promptly forgot them. And I had moritas that were already all, you know, like raisins, exactly. But they were aromatic and wonderful.
Yeah, I think that, I think you're correct in saying that it does work as sort of a preservative or it sort of helps that outer skin of the chili to kind of stay intact. I just think it's the flavor, the smokiness adds such a depth. You know, I think throwing what, you know, we do, like if you're going to make braised short ribs or cook like a low and slow dish, like a Texas-style chili, drop a couple chilies in there and then remove them after you braise, you know, pork or braised beef. It just gives a wonderful flavor and very easy to do.
And also like when you're making a simple tomato sauce.
Yeah.
You know, you just pour a few in, a few chipotles and then, but those you keep, those you keep in there because it's so delicious.
Well, you know, I mentioned that to customers who are on what you said about putting chilies in and out. When people say, oh, I'm not sure how hot I want it, they'll be looking at an Indian recipe, say, and it'll call for like, you know, 10 chilies. I said, listen, the first time you make something, if you're not sure of the heat level, put them in whole. You know, you can taste it, let it sit for a little while, and then you can pull them out and you won't continue getting up. The heat won't develop any further. Other recipes, you're mixing a powder or a paste in, but the idea of putting whole chilies in and out, I think, is a brilliant idea.
But one of the things that I tell anybody who's cooking with chilies is to make sure that it is to your degree of comfort with the heat. There's nothing worse than eating chilies that are going to kill your palate because it's so spicy.
Right, then you can't taste anything.
You know, that you can't taste it. You know, so that's really, really important.
It's funny, we sell a lot of hot sauces, and every once in a while there'll be someone who comes and says, what's your hottest sauce? What's hot? And I said, well, is this a gift, a gag gift, or are you really going to eat it? And that, depending, because we do have some, and they're made with just the oleo resin, the extract, that are just pure heat without flavor, which is not my cup of tea. I like a good spice and a good heat, even a smoked ghost pepper, chipotle, habanero, any of those, but I like flavor.
Absolutely.
So it really has to be a balance with the heat and the flavor.
This episode is brought to you by Hearst Ranch. The Hearst family has raised cattle on California's Central Coast since 1865. Today, Hearst Ranch's signature product is their 100% grass-fed, completely hormone and antibiotic-free beef. The Hearst Ranches have always treated their animals with great care. Their cattle live a completely natural existence as foragers and grazers. Well-managed grazing fertilizes the land naturally, sustains a seasonal rhythm to the ranches, and produces a remarkable meat whose flavor is the authentic taste of the American West. Hearst Ranch beef is available seasonally, May through August, in select Whole Food markets throughout California, and all year round at their retail locations in San Simeon and Paso Robles. And now, HRN listeners in Arizona, Nevada, and California can get Hearst Ranch beef delivered right to their door through Larder Meat Company. Go to lardermeatco.com and shop the 100% grass-fed box to stock your freezer with Hearst Ranch beef. That's LARDER, meatco.com. Learn more about the storied history, farming practices, and conservation efforts of Hearst Ranch at hearstranch.com.
Hello, this is Dana Callan, and I'm the host of Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. Each week, I interview extraordinary women in the world of food and wine. And I've expanded this season to create Giving Broadly, a website devoted to amazing products by extraordinary women entrepreneurs. Check it out for great gifts and ways to amp up your cooking this season. That's givingbroadly.com.
All right, Donna, so rumor has it that you were given a moniker and a nickname in the mid-80s. Could you share with our audience?
Sure. When I was a very new line cook, I was working at the Harvest Restaurant with Chef Bob Kincaid, who just passed away a few weeks ago. I just have to say rest in peace for him. I somehow got handed the jobs whenever we were making anything with chilies, any salsas. This was in 1983, the early days of American food with international influences. Mm-hmm. Bob was an amazing chef, and we had food from really all over the world. So my nickname became Senorita Salsa, which to this day, my girlfriends who I made in that period, we still call each other the Senoritas.
Oh, I love
and
that.
And I'm Senorita Salsa.
Like the ones
I said, but I have said that now we're Senoras. We're not Senoritas anymore.
Like the Tres Amigos.
Yeah.
Well, you ladies still have what you call in Spanish, pegue.
Yeah.
You still have an enormous amount of appeal.
I hope so.
Of course.
Thank you.
You know, I think one of the things that's important to kind of touch upon, you know, chilies often are classified by the Scoville meter, right, or the Scoville level. And basically that's the amount of capsicum or the amount of heat, right, in chilies inherently. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. It's a unit of measure based on it's a little complicated, but chilies are put in water, and then there's a certain level of heat that's measured.
Mm-hmm.
And so something like this Turkish chili is about 35,000. The smoked ghost pepper is about 1 million Scoville units. It goes up from there. The Carolina Reaper, which is the hottest chili that's edible for man, somewhat edible, is, I think, about 30 million.
Yeah.
Which That's is pretty crazy. Brutal. Yeah, you have to be pretty careful when you're handling the really hot chilies. We should probably mention that. When you go into the smoke, the ghost peppers, the scorpion moringas, you have to be very careful how you're handling them.
Yes.
We had this dish at the restaurant, which was what was really interesting about it is that in this place of Yucatan, they cook things twice. They might boil it first or grill it. Or grill it and then boil it. So this is a particular thing. There was escabeche, an escabeche dish from actually Quintana Roo. And it came with roasted peppers, roasted onion, roasted garlic, and one roasted habanero. And we would go up to the table and say, do not eat that chili.
Yeah.
So then people would, of course, eat it. And then, it was like this, the alarm would go off. And because Americans feel like they, the U.S. Americans feel like they want to get hotter and hotter.
Yeah.
We always just to joke around that, jalapenos were the gateway drug to habaneros.
Yeah, totally. Absolutely.
And when habaneros were the hottest chili that we knew. But, you start with jalapeno, you have a little guacamole, you make a little salsa fresca, and then you want more, and then you want more.
It's
it really
like a drug.
Is addicting.
It's like a drug.
Well, spicy chilies release endorphins.
Yeah.
It's proven.
You feel good and you want
and
more.
And mucus, too.
Yeah, and it's but it's also good to boost your immune system as well.
Yeah, a lot of vitamin C, vitamin A, very healthy.
They're good for you, and I think that's important to for everyone to mention. If you have an aversion to heat or spicy food, start with the chipotle. Let that be your introduction, and then move your way up. I think it's also important to mention that chilies. That's why when you have chiles, dried chilies in a recipe, it's so hard to designate the amount because chilies. They vary from year to year, harvest to harvest. Maybe it didn't rain enough, or maybe it was really hot.
Even on the same plant, chilies can have a different amount of heat.
Yep. They tell me that every cutting is until eight. They do eight cuttings, and each one is hotter than the other.
Yeah. So, and I think it's, you know, we're talking about pasillas, chipotles. We've talked a little bit about the spectrum of different dried chilies from around the world. You know, I recently partnered with Cholula with the hot sauce, and I went to Jalisco to the plant to see how it's made. And it was very interesting to see that the majority of the chilies there use dry chili arbol. Yeah. That's the base of the base of most hot sauces is the chili arbol, which is kind of akin to a cayenne. I mean, if you were trying to associate it to something.
Exactly.
And it was very interesting to see the process, how the chilies were ground, how you extract a sauce that's commonplace in a condiment in everyone's kitchens.
Do they start with fresh the arbols or dried?
Dried arbols. Okay. And then, you know, for one of their salsas, they put maybe like one little bag of chili piquin, mm-hmm. Which is that dry little small chili from the north.
The father of all chilies.
Yeah, the chili piquin. And it was very interesting to see the process. And I think this is worth mentioning that most hot sauces that you see in the market are derived from dried chilies.
I have an idea. Mm-hmm. You know, the next sauce that you do for Cholula, you should insist on using the Veracruzan chilies, the mm-hmm. dried chilies, because they have the comapa, which you should have. I mean, I have this, I'll show it to you. It's like a little bell. It's the most floral, wonderful chili you can imagine. Mm-hmm. Plus, they also have a dried serrano chili.
Yeah.
Which is fantastic.
Oh, we have a nice dried smoked serrano.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah. So there's no smoke there.
Yeah, the serrano chile is like the devious old brother of the jalapeno.
Yeah.
It's a little spicier.
It's a little spicier.
Yeah.
But much more floral.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
it's wonderful. So you should tell them.
Yeah. Well, I'll get right on that, Mom. And, you know, like anything else, hopefully the cost will be in line in order for them to produce it on a large scale. You know, one of the ways that I use dried chilies at my restaurant, Johnny Sanchez in New Orleans, is, you know, talking about the pasilla, for instance. I like to take my dried chiles, we de-seed them, we toast them, obviously, to release their essential oils and all their wonderful aroma. Then, you know, you reconstitute them. I like to reconstitute my chiles in stock as opposed to water. So now you have another layer of flavor there. So I like maybe a chicken broth and then actually reconstitute my chiles so they become pliable, they become soft, and then we'll puree those pasillas with roasted onion and garlic, and then we'll put some tamarind paste in there.
Yeah.
Oh,
and
nice.
That adds the acid and the bitterness. And so we'll have that sweetness and the heat from the pasilla and that really bracing acid from the tamarind. And then we use that typically with lamb shoulder and adobo.
You know, when I'm making chilies, I don't always reconstitute them. Mm-hmm. Because particularly in moles and everything, what I like to do is I like to toast them, mm-hmm. and then grind them up in the food processor, and use that. It's so much easier. You can fry that, but toast them. Then it's so much easier to incorporate into sauces.
Aron, I wanted to ask you one thing. Often when I've toasted and then soaked to rehydrate dried chili, say, in water, I often find the water is very bitter. Mm-hmm. So before I make the puree, I usually throw away most of that water and then add a little water or stock or whatever to do the puree. So I wanted to ask you, have you noticed that, or does the chicken stock kind of mask some of that bitterness?
That's a very good question. Yeah, I think the chicken stock, because it has some fat in it, I think really helps kind of tamper down some of that bitterness. But you're right. It's challenging sometimes because I think when you toast the chilies, that also maybe adds to some of that bitterness or that soaking liquid.
Right, if you over-toast them, it
absolutely
can be too
and
harsh.
And I think that's really important. And what I've gone ahead and started doing is when I make stocks, for instance, I like to actually toast and roast my vegetables instead of put those charred chilies and those charred vegetables in that stock instead of just putting, you know, regular mirepoix or whatever, like the French technique. So that really adds another depth of flavor.
Yeah, and you know what's really hot in Mexico right now is this mole made out of ashes.
Yeah.
And I just tried it the other day, and it was amazing.
Yeah, they call them, sometimes you see them called chimoles.
I don't think so. This is mole de ceniza.
Mole de ceniza?
Yeah, and I made it the other day. So you actually burn the seeds, mm-hmm. and toast most of the chilies, burn the seeds in a tortilla, so, and it's a black, satiny black dish.
Yeah, it's very popular.
You thicken it with masa, which we're going to talk about later on with a friend of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just this wonderful thing. So a lot of this ashi, you know, in for instance, in Pátzcuaro, in Pátzcuaro, Michoacán, that beautiful lake town where they have the butterfly nets and mm-hmm. this the most fabulous Day of the Dead celebrations. In Pátzcuaro has this tamales made with ashes.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And it's like this amazing flavor, you know. So this smoked thing.
The ashes mixed in with the masa?
Yeah. So in Mexico, there's been a long tradition of this smoked kind of burned things. And it's logical because, you know, that carbon is a natural antacid.
Yeah, digestive.
Helps you know, it. So it's a digestive. So it's understood, you know, they were so wise that they...
We wonder, some things happen by mistake, and then they're like, oh, but hey, wait. Yeah. That turned out pretty good. Let's not make it a mistake, and let's make it...
That's how they say that Worcester sauce was invented or something like that, where they put a bunch of different dry fish and different ingredients and forgot about it, and it fermented in a kitchen, in a closet somewhere, and they tasted it, and they're like, yeah, this is pretty good.
It's a brave person that tasted it.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's really important. I think that this idea of having ashy food or burnt things is becoming very popular in other kinds of cuisines. I'm seeing a lot of high-end chefs do sauces like burnt alums, which is a fancy word for onions.
Yeah. How about that guy from San Francisco that does that burnt burnt bread sauce?
Yeah, the burnt bread sauce, that's very popular. We're at its core, we're talking about smoky, you know, very deep, rich flavors. And so it is a trend that is definitely... I think here to stay.
It's here to stay. And fortunately, you can go get all this other smoked chilies, not just chipotles, mm-hmm. but all this wonderful smoked chilies at Calustias. You know, I live there.
Mm-hmm.
And every time Aaron comes to the house, says to me, welcome to Calustias Midtown.
Exactly.
Thank you, Zarella. We really appreciate your loyalty and support.
Well, I just want to tell you one little sort of goodbye story, which is very sweet. The first time that I went to Oaxaca, I started talking with a Mije couple. And they had their two beautiful children. They were all done up in their traditional wear. And they were talking back and forth in Mije and Spanish. And I asked him, what do you teach your children first? And he said, to say hello and respect their elders.
Absolutely.
Beautiful.
I think that's a great piece of advice.
I'm so happy that you were able to join us, because there's nobody like you that knows so much about everything.
Yeah.
You know, the people I research say to me, thank you for taking me into account. Gracias por tomarme en cuenta. So we thank you so much for agreeing to do this today.
Para servirle. My pleasure. Thank you. And thank you for thinking of me. And as I said, we've known each other for a long time, and it's
through
great
Lori.
To come. It's nice to come full circle and stay in touch all these years later.
Yes.
It's great, and to still be relevant in our relationships.
Oh, no, this is, and we're going to be, I'll be better about coming to visit you. For everyone, Donna Abramson has been our guest today on Cooking in Mexican from A to Z. She is the Calustians Manager of Operations. Basically, she's the diva of all ingredients in the world. And please seek her out. She's an in-house liaison to the food world in general. Calustians, opened in 1944. It originally serviced the Armenian community. And then in the 60s, New York had a huge influx of Indians from India move in. And then they started to, bolster their selection with Indian spices. And as I said earlier, this shop proudly boasts more than 10,000 food products from over 80 countries. Calustians on 28th and Lexington here in Manhattan is a definite for any foodie out there. Please seek out Donna if you have any questions, but not just about dry chilies, but food in general. She's a wealth of knowledge, and we are so, so blessed to have you here and reconnect. And hopefully everyone out there, we shed some light on the beautiful world of smoked chilies, how to use them, how to seek them out, their flavor profiles. This is really what we wanted to accomplish today on Cooking Mexican A to Z. I'm Aaron Sanchez.
I'm Zarella Martinez. And if you have any questions, you can always contact me at zarella@zarella.com.
Or myself at aaron@chefaronsanchez.com. And Donna?
Donna, D-O-N-A, @calustians.com.
Thank you very much for listening.
We are more excited than ever to continue our deep dive into Mexican ingredients and cooking techniques on Heritage Radio. Thank you very much.
Cooking in Mexican from A to Z is powered by Simple Cast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without your support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like. Tell your friends and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.